let's at least begin to talk about Theages, this little Platonic dialogue. The subtitle is On Wisdom. That was probably added by a later editor. And it's a very peculiar subtitle to add because philosophy is never mentioned here at all. You know, the love of wisdom is never mentioned here at all. Nature is never mentioned here at all. The soul is never mentioned here at all. Now, the soul and nature are two things that are, if you will, models of what ancient philosophers investigated, nature and the soul. And they're not mentioned at all. And so this discussion is not what you'd call a philosophical discussion. Or put it this way, it's a discussion between a philosopher and a non-philosopher. And the discussion never rises to the level of actually dealing philosophically with the questions that it discusses. Because if it were to rise to the level of philosophy, it would begin to mention nature and the soul. Let me just state that dogmatically. When you talk philosophy and you're serious about it, you'll end up talking about what's natural, and you'll talk about specifically the nature of the soul. This is what Aristophanes derives his wisdom from, ultimately, understanding of the human nature, and not just the nature of the body, right? Even the sophists knew the body wanted, but the nature of the human soul and what its needs are and what kind of care it requires. That is the center of what's distinct about Aristophanes, and it's the center of Platonic philosophy too. Ultimately, what Socrates is about, again, is the care of the soul, self-perfection, the perfection of our moral sensibility, and the perfection of our tastes too. Our aesthetic taste, our capacity to appreciate the beautiful. These are the two main aspects of the care of the soul. Yet that's never mentioned here. And so the first point is that this dialogue is not something that makes explicit reference to philosophy. It's not philosophical by nature. So what kind of discussion is it? Well, it's a discussion between Socrates, who is a philosopher, but who's keeping his philosophy close to his chest, so to speak, and this young man named Theages, who is mentioned in the Republic. And let me just read you the passage in the Republic where Theages is mentioned. I had this marked, and then I picked up the book to gesture with it, and lost the place.
What on his third point, is it AC?
Oh, is it at the bottom of... Yeah. Oh, gosh, well, that's great. I was looking in the index to find that. Okay, well, anyway, it's in book 6 of the Republic.
You're
a real scholar.
I thought I saw it before.
Okay. Well, I guess Thomas Pangle knows this too. He's a translator here. He's talking about the kinds of people who might be attracted to philosophy or politics. This is Socrates. And he says, and perhaps a very few men from another art who justly despise it because they have good natures might come to her in philosophy. And then he goes on, and the bridle of our comrade Theages might be such as to restrain him. For in Theages' case, all the other conditions for an exile from philosophy were present, but the sickliness of his body, shutting him out of politics, restrains him. Okay. Theages is a valetudinarian. He's sickly. And his sickliness prevents him from entering into politics. Now, the dramatic date of the Republic is 411 B.C. Okay? And the dramatic date of the Theages is 409 B.C., okay, 2 years later. Now, I don't know what to make of this fact. Apparently, if you read the Republic, and it's the same Theages, Socrates already knows him. And he knows that he's the kind of person who is prevented from politics, from entering into politics, because of the sickliness of his body. Even if he had other things that would restrain him from going into politics, the fact that he's so sickly sort of thing that prevents it. So if it's the same Theages, we're dealing with somebody who's rather sickly here, but who has a desire to go into the political realm, but can't. And then, so here we have this dialogue on wisdom. Demodocus is a country gentleman. He's a country gentleman. He's also involved in politics. He's got a certain amount of money. And he's an important man in Athens. According to the note, and he might be a general mentioned by Thucydides in book 4 of the Peloponnesian War. Theages is apparently dead in 399 BC when Socrates is on trial because he's mentioned in the Apology, and so apparently poor Theages had wasted away by that time, and he is mentioned in the Republic as a sickly person. So Demodocus, the general, the country gentleman, brings his son Theages to Socrates, and it seems like they meet by chance. Socrates is apparently out and about, and Demodocus and Theages run into him. And so let's just begin. Socrates, I've been needing to talk to you in private about some matters, if you have leisure, and even if you don't, and your business is not very important. Now, this is important because it reveals what Demodocus knows about Socrates. Demodocus doesn't realize that Socrates never has any business. That he doesn't, you know, he doesn't do anything practical, that he's always at leisure. And make some time for my sake. And Socrates says, well, I happen to be at leisure in any case. And indeed, for your sake, very much so. If you wish to speak about something, you may. And would you like to go over here out of the way into the portico of Zeus the Liberator? So this is important. He also asked Socrates if he would like to speak in private. Now, we know that Socrates did speak in private with people, but one of the things that Plato and Xenophon try to do in defending Socrates against the charges is they always try and argue that he was always in the open, he was always in public talking with people. And Demodocus wants him to speak in private, and Socrates, well, doesn't really go for that, but they do go, where they do go to speak in private is really in the public. It's a stoa, or portico, that was erected to Zeus, the Liberator, because in honor of Zeus's help in delivering the Athenians from the Persians. And this, of course, harkens back to the previous generation that fought off the Persians. And the previous generation in Athens was a generation of tough, old republicans, if you will, strong believers in the republican virtues of Athens. They had been supplanted by this time by a generation you call radically democratic, led by people like Pericles, demagogues. And Pericles, the demagogue, and other demagogues had transformed Athens from a tough-minded, independent little city-state into an empire. It represents two generations and two different forms of life. Athens, the old republic, small, self-contained, more concerned with its independence than anything else, versus the imperial Athens, sprawling all over the Mediterranean, constantly grasping for new conquests and new taxes, that eventually overstepped itself and was destroyed in the Peloponnesian War, which came to an end in 404 BC, only 5 years after the date of this dialogue. And it's clear that Demodocus is a farmer. And his understanding of how things grow is based on his understanding of farming. And he's trying to deal with how his son will grow, how his son has to be educated. And he's quite disturbed because his son keeps talking about wanting to become, well, wants. Okay, so let's go into the text. On the first page again, Demodocus says, as regards the plants, it is very easy for us who farm the earth to make all the preparations that precede the planting and to do the planting itself. And when what has been planted takes on life, then a great difficult and vexatious tending begins. And it seems likely that the same holds concerning human beings. From my own business, I draw inferences about the rest. Now, this is interesting because, in a sense, what Demodocus is he's sort of like the natural philosopher. He has an understanding of nature from tending it. And he wants to apply that understanding of non-human nature to the tending of human beings, namely his son. And he's coming into a certain amount of conflict with that because his son does not want to be tended like a plant or one of the livestock. He has needs that are distinctly human that are chafing against his father's tutelage here. And there's a conflict between father and son, and finally the father has been led to the city to try and seek out some teacher for Theages, and he comes across Socrates. Maybe he intended to come across Socrates, we don't know, but then they have this conversation. He goes, for as regards this son of mine here, the planting, or the child begetting, whichever one ought to call it, was the easiest of all things. The upbringing has been vexatious and has made me anxious with constant fear concerning him. There are many other things that might be mentioned, but the desire that is now present in him is for me a great source of fear, for it's not ignoble, but it is risky. since he is before us, Socrates, desiring, as he declares, to become wise. Now, this is interesting because he wants to become wise, yet the way the dialogue is carried out keeps philosophy, true philosophy, sort of hidden. So this notion of becoming wise, we have to understand it in that light. What Theages wants is wisdom understood in a popular way, not understood as Socrates understands it, but understood in a popular way. And as it turns out, it's wisdom as understood by the sophists who claim to make people wise. And it becomes clear that the reason why he's desiring this is because he's been in contact with young men who have spent time in the city talking philosophy or talking with sophists and who have brought this information out to the country, and he's begun to envy them. Now, if the account in the Republic is correct, Theages is already known to Socrates as somebody with an interest in these sorts. Theages is maybe within the orbit of Socrates and his companions already, although his father is unaware of this. And this is very much like Strepsiades and Pheidippides. Strepsiades doesn't even know who Socrates is, but Pheidippides does know his name. And so the son is more urbane than the father in both of the texts. And again, the father is as a farmer in both of the texts. So there's a parallel that emerges here. And the father does know that pursuing wisdom is a dangerous thing, and there's charlatans around, although he does regard it as somewhat noble. And he says that it's money is no object. He apparently has a lot of money, and he's willing to lavishly spend it on his son, which sounds like Strepsiades again, too. And Strepsiades spoils his son by spending his money on him. He's reposed him for a long time, but he's finally giving in, too, which is a sign of being an indulgent father. And, of course, many indulgent parents always tell themselves the story that Democritus tells them, which is at 122a, a little below that. Now, for a while I held him back with placating talk, but since I can't any longer, I consider it best to give in to him, lest perchance he be corrupted by frequenting someone when I'm not there. You can't control your kid, so you might as well just. So now I've come for this very purpose, to place this boy with one of those who are reputed to be sophists. You have therefore showed up at a fine moment for us, you whom I would especially like to take counsel with when I'm actually going to do something about such matters. And Socrates replies a little below this, well, Democritus, it is said certainly that counsel is a sacred thing. And here Socrates is appealing to the sacred, the divine. And Socrates always appeals to the divine when he's talking with ordinary folks. Okay? This is a pattern that you find in the Platonic dialogues. He's speaking in the public language. This is the public language. It's a sacred thing. If indeed it is ever sacred, it would be in this case, concerning the matter on which you're taking counsel. And then here Socrates is making claims about things he knows, okay? Those who believe he doesn't know anything or claims not to know anything, please listen up. For a human being could not take counsel about anything more divine than about education. Nothing's more important than that. Why? Because education cultivates the soul, and that's the most important thing you can do, both for himself and for those who belong to him. First, though, let you and I come to an agreement as to whatever this may be about which we are taking counsel. Otherwise, if I should take it to be one thing and you another, then after we've been together for a while, we will perceive ourselves as laughable. I don't want to seem too comic. And, of course, one of the main reasons why the clouds is funny is all the equivocations that go on. They think they're talking about the same thing, but they're really not. Well, let's talk about meters. Yes, I haven't had any barley today. I'd like 10 meters, please. You know, and that's one of the common conceits of the clouds, and so I think this is a reference to the clouds. But here, Socrates is making sure that the old farmer and he know exactly what they're talking about, so they don't misunderstand one another and become comical like they are in the clouds. Socrates at the top of 134. I'm indeed saying what's correct, though not entirely. I change it slightly, for it occurs to me that this youth may desire not this thing that we suppose him to desire, but something else. And then again, we would be even more absurd taking counsel about something else. So again, he's trying to say, look, you know, not only do we need to understand ourselves, we need to understand what he wants. And so he begins his discussion with Theages. And the name Theages, according to the note, can mean either revering God or envying God. And this is an interesting ambiguity, and it's the very same ambiguity that you see in the battle between the just and the unjust speech. Because the just speech says we should revere the gods, and unjust speech says, okay, well, if you revere them, then you should act like them, which is to want to be them, which is to envy them, not so much to look up to them, but want to be like them or to be them. And, of course, this is one of the tools of corruption. And the name is ambiguous in a delicious way, which indicates, you know, the ambiguity of religious education for morals. It can make you either envy the gods and become corrupt, or fear the gods and become pious. And this is all wrapped up together. And this instability or ambiguity is, of course, one of the things that so makes a religion such.
34. Which do you call wise, the ones who know concerning the matter, whatever it may be, about which they are knowers, or the ones who don't?
So are wise people knowers or not knowers?
The question. The ones who are knowers, I say, says Theages. What then? Didn't your father teach and educate you in the things in which the other sons of gentlemanly farmers here are educated, such as letters, cithara playing, wrestling, and other kinds of contests? Yes, he has. Do you still suppose, then, that you are lacking in some knowledge, which is fitting that your father look to in your behalf? I do. What is this? Tell us, so that we may gratify you. He knows, Socrates, because I have often told him, but he says these things to you on purpose, as if he didn't know what I desire. And with other talk of this kind, he battles against me and isn't willing to place me with anyone. The son is chafing against the father again. But the things you said to him before were said, as it were, without witnesses. Now, however, make me your witness, and in my presence declare what this wisdom is that you desire.
And then he asks, well, is it the kind of wisdom that people who pilot ships have, you know, or steersmen, right, navigators? And he says, no, that's the piloting art, and that's not the kind of wisdom he wants. But what about the art of the charioteer? Is this the kind of wisdom that you want? And what's being done here is that wisdom is being identified with a kind of art, a kind of knowledge. And this is a very peculiar thing to do. What Socrates is basically doing now is he's testing Theages. He wants to see if Theages is the kind of student he wants to take on, which is something that's conspicuously absent with the Socrates of the Crime. All that Strepsiades had to do was just say, I'm here to be a student. That's fine. There was no test. Whereas Socrates is testing a prospective student here. And he's asking him, which kind of knowledge is wisdom? And the right answer to that question is, well, let me ask you. I mean, what kind of knowledge is wisdom? Well,
doing the right thing in the right situation.
But there's a sense in which wisdom really isn't a kind of knowledge, when you get right down to it. What Socrates does is he begins with a false premise built into the argument. What kind of knowledge is the wisdom you want? And really, the right answer would be something like this. Well, it isn't really knowledge, because wisdom is the ability to make right use of things, right, including knowledge. So knowledge isn't wisdom if you can use knowledge foolishly. Okay, and all of the kinds of knowledge that he brings out as examples, all these different crafts or arts, like piloting, charioteering, medicine, all of these arts can be used foolishly, and therefore they can't be wisdom. Okay, they need wisdom, but they're not wisdom. And so wisdom and ignorance are being opposed to one another here, and wisdom and knowledge are being identified. That's really not the way to look at it. Because wisdom is not equal to knowledge, and the clearest way to appreciate this fact is this. What's the opposite of wisdom? Foolishness is folly. And the opposite of knowledge is ignorance, right? So even if you're not sure whether wisdom and knowledge are the same thing, you can get some clue to answer that by asking, are folly and ignorance the same thing? Are ignorant people fools? Are all foolish people ignorant? Not necessarily. Exactly. It's possible to be very knowledgeable, have a lot of knowledge, right, and still engage in folly, and that's Socrates in the clouds, right? Mm-hmm. And it's possible to have a certain amount of wisdom and still be ignorant. And interestingly enough, in the clouds, Strepsiades actually shows more wisdom than Socrates. Because, and this is one little dramatic detail I neglected to mention, but remember when Socrates, or when Strepsiades leaves the thinkery after he's been bounced or expelled, and he goes to Pheidippides, and he tries to get Pheidippides to go into the thinkery, and he tells Pheidippides, first of all, that he swears him to secrecy on the matter, and then he informs him that Zeus doesn't exist. So Strepsiades is much wiser in practical sense, because he realizes that this is dynamite. And he's not going to just tell it to anybody, and he's not going to tell it to his son if his son goes and blabs it around. He wants him to be secretive about this, even though Socrates isn't. And that is, in a sense, an indication that as dumb as old Strepsiades is, and as ignorant as he is, he's no fool. He's managed to farm all these years. He's managed to raise a kid. He's spoiled him, but still, he's raised him. You can't do that without a little bit of practical sense, and that's what he displays. And so, ignorance and wisdom can go together just as folly and knowledge can go together. And so, these things are not equivalent. Wisdom is not equivalent to knowledge. Folly is not equivalent to ignorance. And yet, if you look at this whole discussion very carefully, the underlying assumption is that wisdom and knowledge are the same, and that folly and ignorance are the same. Now, there are many discussions in Plato where this is done, and it's done in a systematic way in a number of Plato's dialogues. And the reason why Plato does this is that Plato teaches by indirection. The lesson that Plato teaches is really not going to be explicitly stated in any of the dialogues. And he says this in one of his letters, that he never states his teaching explicitly. Well, if that's the case, then why read his dialogues if there's no teaching stated there? Well, there is the teaching isn't stated, but it is implied. And it's implied in this way. A problem is created in the dialogue, okay, that begs for a certain kind of solution. And if you figure out what that solution is, that's Plato's answer. That's Plato's position. So Plato forces you to figure out what his teachings are. They're never stated directly, but they can be indirectly inferred when you realize what the problems are in the dialogues and then try and figure out what the solutions are. And now poor Theages is going to be run around this little exercise wheel a little bit, and then Socrates is just going to do the strangest thing. He's just going to try and get rid of him. After a certain point, Socrates tries to get rid of Theages. Okay, and it's interesting because Theages won't go, and Socrates is in trouble. So anyway, he goes through several arts. There's piloting, charioteering, medicine, and then at the top of 136, there's the musical art. And then after that, there's gymnastic. And then Theages finally says he doesn't want to do any of these arts. 124a, he says, those in the city, it seems to me. This is what he wants to learn about. The art that rules those in the city, not the art that rules the sick, or the art that rules the exercising, or the art that rules singers and choruses, but the art that rules people in cities. That's what he wants. And then Socrates says, oh, okay, well, that would be a kind of controlling or ruling art. So, would you like to be a farmer? Because farmers rule the threshers and the reapers and the harvesters and the sowers. No, I don't want to be a farmer. If he did, he'd just stay in the farm. Well, what about the art that rules sawyers and borers and planers and turners, namely the carpenter's art? No, he doesn't want to do that either. Well, what art do you want to know? And at the bottom of 136, Socrates says, but perhaps that by which we have knowledge of how to rule all these arts, as well as the farmers and the carpenters and all the public craftsmen and private non-craftsmen, both women and men, perhaps this is the wisdom which you're seeking. So what he's saying is, do you want a comprehensive art, the art that rules all the other arts? Okay. Now, this is not in any way separating from the assumption that wisdom is equal to a kind of knowledge. But what it's doing is it's saying that wisdom is a kind of comprehensive technical knowledge that rules the arts. and puts all the arts in their place. And so this is getting closer to wisdom, though, because let me just state this in a sort of dogmatic way. But for Plato, wisdom is the capacity to make right use of all things. Okay? It has these two capacities, or two aspects, right use and all things. It's not wisdom if it doesn't have this dimension of rightness to it, or this comprehensiveness of being able to rule over all things, make right use over all things. If you were to say that wisdom is just the capacity to use all things, that would be to say it's a kind of comprehensive art, which is what he's referring to here. And asking Theages, is this what you want? The art of using everything? This is comprehensive technical knowledge. But there's no mention of the good here. And that's what's so crucial. Because to be truly wise, in Plato's sense, you have to know what the good is. And make good use, or right use of all things. And then what he does is he gives a list of tyrants. So didn't these people, all these tyrants, Aegisthus, Peleus, Periander, Archelaus, Hippias, and so forth, didn't they all have this comprehensive technical capacity to use everything? And Theages agrees. And then he says, okay, so what do we call Bacchus and Sibyl and Philetus? What's their art? They're soothsayers. And what's the art of all these men that we named earlier? Well, they're tyrants, is the answer. And so what Theages says he wants to learn is to be a tyrant. And tyranny is identified with comprehensive technical knowledge, and this is what he thinks wisdom is. Wisdom is tyranny, and tyranny is understood as comprehensive technological skill or art. The art that rules over and can manage all the other arts. But there's no reference to doing it rightly or wrongly here. It's just a purely neutral technological skill. A morally neutral technological skill. And of course that makes perfectly good sense when you look at the immoral behavior of all these tyrants, and the notes detail some of these people's behavior patterns. And then the wisdom is tyranny, understood as comprehensive technical skill. Now at the top of 138, Socrates sneaks in something though that's very crucial. He says, but now, do you see, since he has accused you in my presence, shall we in common, I and you, deliberate about whom we should send him to, and by means of whose company he might become a wise tyrant? If wisdom and tyranny are the same thing, then it would be repetitive to talk about a wise tyrant. But if it's meaningful to talk about a wise tyrant, that implies that you can also have foolish tyrants as well. And if you can have a foolish tyrant, then being a tyrant is not equivalent to being wise. So there's a distinction between wisdom and tyranny that's being sneaked in here. And then he goes on and he quotes Euripides. There's a line about the center of the page. Tyrants are wise enough, are wise through keeping company with the wise. And so here's a sense in which tyrants are not wise in and of themselves, but wise derivatively by keeping company with wise people. And who would the wise be? Well, sophists or philosophers, but somebody who's wise. And then the question is, well, in what are these people wise? They go through the example of farming. Farmers are wise through keeping company with the wise, and we ask, wise in what? And of course, that would be wise in farming. A farmer becomes wise by keeping company with somebody who's wise in the art of farming. And a tyrant, therefore, would keep... And then the next example is cooks are wise through keeping company with the wise. And who are these wise people? People who are wise in the ways of cookery. Now, it's interesting that Socrates refers to cooks here, because in the Gorgias, which is a dialogue I'd love to teach you, in the Gorgias, Socrates talks about cooks or pastry chefs. A cook is a person who is basically panders to your tastes or your appetites, flatters your tastes. Doesn't make you a good person, but just sort of flatters you. Yeah, yes, Mentai, a flatterer, exactly, who doesn't improve your health, but because that sometimes that means you don't sugarcoat things, right? But instead feeds you all kinds of sugarcoated things that you like that are bad for you. And this is a perfect analogy to politicians. And he draws this analogy out in great detail in the Gorgias between politicians and pastry chefs, because they're both flatterers that sell you sugar-coated things that rot you away. And then he goes on and talks about wrestlers, and then he talks about tyrants. But what do tyrants know? And it's very peculiar. He just can't get what tyrants know out of Theages. Theages is not a very good student. And Socrates just keeps going through this, trying to get Theages to say, okay, well, what do tyrants know that makes them wise? At the bottom of 139, there's a very interesting passage. First, Socrates says, what, didn't you assert that you desire this wisdom by which you might rule over all the citizens? If you did thus, would you be anything other than a tyrant? Theages says, for my part, I would pray, I suppose, to become tyrant, preferably over all human beings, and if not over as many as possible. And so would you, I suppose, and all the other human beings, or moreover, probably to become a god. This is what he would pray for, and all human beings would pray for, to become gods or tyrants over all men. But this is not what I said I desire, he said. Okay. He said he would pray for these things, and everybody would, but that's not what he desires. What he desires is somehow independent of what he would like to pray for. It's something that he wants to be able to get on his own. And then it becomes very clear that what he really wants is not to be a tyrant, but to be a demagogue. The examples at the top of 140 are Themistocles, Pericles, and Cimon. These were the leaders of the popular party in Athens that created Athens' great empire and eventually led it to ruin. This is what he really wants to be. He doesn't want to be a tyrant, but a leader of the democracy. Yeah, a democratic statesman. This is what he really longs for. And near the bottom of the page, it's very clear that Socrates thinks, he basically says, look, if you want to be a demagogue, then you should go and study with the demagogues. You should follow them, because what the kind of knowledge they have that allows them to use their cities and the cities of other people, which is a hint about the imperial nature of Athens, right, is based on practical knowledge. So if you want to become a demagogue, you get an internship, basically, with them and learn the art of demagoguery. Demagogue just means leader of the people, literally. But then he says, and this is just above where it says D at the bottom of 140, he says, or is it your opinion that you will be wise in these matters which these men practice by having intercourse with certain others rather than with these men themselves? Intercourse means interaction here. And, of course, he's referring to the sophists. And Theages says something, and this is very funny. This is comical. And Socrates is the butt of the comedy here, as he is in the clouds. Theages says, well, I have heard, Socrates, the arguments they assert you present to the effect that the sons of these men versed in the political art are in no way better than the sons of shoemakers. And it is my opinion that what you say is very true from the things I am able to perceive. So I would be mindless if I were to suppose that one of these men would hand over his wisdom to me, but benefit his own son not at all. Socrates has been trapped by his own teaching here. Apparently it's gotten back to Theages, which is an indication that Theages was in constant contact with people who discussed things with Socrates. But Socrates approved, and we find this in a number of dialogues, that these statesmen really don't have an art, because if they had an art, they would be able to teach it. And you'd think that they'd teach it to their own children, first of all, yet the sons of Pericles and all these others turned out to be political ignoramuses. They didn't grow up learning this. And Theages heard this argument, and he's been convinced, therefore, that he should not go and be a student of the demagogues. Now, Socrates, of course, wants him to. And at this point, Socrates is really just trying to get rid of him. He does not want to take Theages on as a student. And so he's trying to place him with somebody else. First the demagogues. And then what he says is, he says, well, why not just take up, not with the demagogue, but with a gentleman, he says, as a teacher at the center of 141. Now then, when you yourself are doing these same things to your father, are you amazed and do you blame him if he is a loss as to what to do and where to send you? For we will place you with whomever you might wish of the gentlemen. Athenian, at least, first in the things that pertain to the political art, who will keep company with you gratis, free of charge. Okay. So this is the next thing he wants to do. He says, okay, you don't want to study with demagogues, why not with the gentlemen? Now, the gentlemen represent the older faction in Athens, not the followers of the demagogues, but the more conservative faction represented by, say, Strepsiades in the clouds, by Demodocus, his father, and by Aristophanes' own political sympathies. These are the people who didn't think that Athens should have an empire, who resisted the wide use of democratic voting and things like that, who thought that good government meant that you should limit the franchise and you should have good men, gentlemen, running things, rather than any guy who can whip up a mob into action. And so these are the next group that he wants to place the kid with. And these would be the friends of his own father. Okay, on the other hand, you won't spend any money. He's trying to sell him. I mean, it's not going to cost you anything, okay? And also, your reputation will not be harmed by keeping company with bad men, either demagogues or sophists, right? And Theages says, look here, Socrates, aren't you one of the gentlemen? Because if you would be willing to keep company with me, that will suffice and I will seek no one else. And this, of course, is what Socrates does not want to do at all. He wants to avoid, at all costs, taking on Theages as a student. Now, why he does this is a question we need to deal with later. And Demodocus pipes up at this point, though, and he's quite emphatic. He says, oh, Socrates, what he says isn't bad, and at the same time it would gratify me, for there's nothing I would consider a greater godsend than if this boy were satisfied with your company and you were willing to keep company with this boy. Indeed, I'm even ashamed to say how intensely I wish it, but I beseech both of you, you be willing to keep company with this boy and not to seek to have intercourse with anyone, and you, to the Theages, not to seek to have intercourse with anyone except Socrates. And he will relieve me of many fearful thoughts, for now I am very fearful on his account, lest he fall in with someone else, such as will corrupt this youth. Okay, so here's a father who's saying, Socrates, take on my son as your student because I don't want him to be corrupted by somebody else. Now, of course, Socrates is shown as a corrupter of the youth in the clouds and accused of corrupting the youth in his trial. And you can see the apologetic, the defensive nature of this text. It's an attempt to portray Socrates in a way that in a sense, refutes some of the claims of the clouds. Here, Socrates is being treated as a man not who corrupts the youth, but as the person who could prevent Theages from being corrupted. However, Socrates isn't, well, put it this way, if Plato really wanted to show Socrates as a real nice guy, though, of course Socrates would have said, sure, come on aboard. But of course, Socrates doesn't. And in fact, what Socrates tries to do is tries to hook him up with a sophist by the end of the thing, the real corruptors of the youth. So in a way, Socrates is a corrupter of the youth, not by design, but by his refusal to take on this student, okay, which is an interesting point. Socrates doesn't benefit everybody who he comes into contact with. He keeps himself to himself.
Do you think that this is kind of an entrance exam that he's giving it?
Yeah, I mean, and I think, well,
dialogue.
Yeah, exactly. And really, the earlier part of the dialogue where they're questioning about these different arts is sort of the entrance exam. And then when he starts saying, well, look, you know, why don't you study with the demagogues? Why don't you study with the gentlemen? He's trying to get rid of him and pass him off to somebody else.
Well, he wouldn't be a suitable.
Yeah, Socrates has decided that Theages isn't a suitable student. He's not going to get into the thinkery, in other words. Okay. Finally, at the center of 142, he says, well, look, why don't you go to Prodicus of Chios, or Gorgias of Leontini, or Polus of Agrigentium? This is where it says 128a. These were prominent sophists. He's trying to send the boy to the sophists. He doesn't want to deal with him, which is really kind of strange. And then what he says is that, you know, these people do have knowledge. They can teach you things, but I don't have any knowledge, Socrates says. And at the bottom of 142, where it says B in the margin, he says, for I know none of these blessed and noble subjects of knowledge. I wish I did. Rather, I always say surely that I happen to know, so to speak, nothing, except a certain small subject of knowledge, what pertains to erotic love. Now, the Greek there is this ta erotica, the erotic things.
As regards this subject of knowledge, to be sure I rank myself as wondrously clever beyond anyone, whether human beings of the past or of the present. This is what Socrates knows, that he knows the erotic things.
Is this an example of impiety that could be disturbed?
Well, it's certainly an example of boasting. I don't know if it would be considered impiety, because I don't know what the attitudes were about that,
yeah.
Whether only the gods are supposed to know love or not. Because what eros means, or the erotic things mean, it's knowledge of the soul. For Plato, when you look in the different dialogues where Socrates claims to have knowledge of eros, it's equivalent to knowledge of the nature of the soul. Socrates never explicitly mentions the soul in this text, but when he does talk about the soul, he uses this term eros. And later, his knowledge of the soul will take another form. It'll take the form of what he calls his sign, the daimonion. So let's go to that. The bottom of 142, Theages says, "Do you see, Father, Socrates is still not at all, in my opinion, willing to spend some time with me, since for my part I'm ready, if you were willing. But he says these things to us in jest. He just treats this as a joke. Because I know boys of my age and a little older, who before they kept company with him were of no account, but since they started to frequent this man, in a very brief time, became manifestly superior to all those to whom they were previously inferior." Socrates says, "Do you know, then, what sort of thing this is, child of Demodocus? I do, by Zeus, that if you wish, I too shall become like those." Socrates says, "No, good fellow, but it has escaped your notice what sort of thing this is. I shall explain to you." And it's kind of obscure what he says. Do you know what this is? Is he like pointing to something? What does this refer to? Does this refer to something that he's just said? I think this refers to his knowledge of erotic things. Do you know what this is, this knowledge of erotic things? And he says, no. He treats it as a joke, and Socrates says, Theages, do you know what this knowledge is? I do, by Zeus, that if you wish, I shall too become like those. No, that's not, he doesn't understand. He doesn't see what Socrates is referring to. He doesn't even know what the question is, in a sense. And Socrates says, no, good fellow, but it has escaped your notice what sort of thing this is. I guess he's referring to his knowledge of erotic things. It's kind of obscure. I shall explain to you, for there is something demonic, which by divine dispensation has followed upon me beginning from childhood. Now, I don't think it begins from childhood. But let's just put that aside for now. This is a voice which, when it comes, always signals me to turn away from what I am going to do, but never urges on. And if one of my friends consults with me and the voice comes, it's the same. It turns away and will not allow the action. And to those things I will furnish you witnesses. And then he talks about a number of people who have failed to heed Socrates' divine sign and have come to ruin. And then basically what he's saying is this. He's saying, Theages, my divine sign has said not to take you on as a student. And this divine sign is, I think, made equivalent to his knowledge of eros, his daimonion. And now daimonion refers to a little daimon, right? And a daimon refers to a half-divine, half-mortal being that exists in between the realm of the gods and the mortals. And that would be like an angel, for instance. And his daimonion that he refers to is a little angelic being. And eros, if you read Plato's Symposium, is treated as a daimon, as one of these things that lies between the mortal and immortal. And so I think that his daimonion refers to the erotic things that he talks about, or to love. And I do believe that what the daimon represents is understanding of the soul, the nature of the soul. But that also is at the core of knowledge of right and wrong for Plato. What's good is what perfects the human soul. What's bad or evil is what corrupts it. So to know the nature of the soul and the forces that move through it, and what perfects it and what corrupts it, is to know the difference between right and wrong. And that is moral knowledge. Okay. And this is what he refers to by his daimonion and by his knowledge of eros, or love, the erotic things. He could literally just say the erotic things. That's the best way of translating the Greek.
His knowledge of erotic things, or his daimonion, refers to his knowledge of the soul and his knowledge of right and wrong. Now, the question is this innate in human beings? Well, I would say yes and no. It's clearly innate if you understand it as a capacity that we can all develop. But it's not innate as something that's actualized. Because there are many people who don't know it. And so the issue is this. Theages does have this capacity to know the difference between right and wrong. Everybody does. However, Socrates' refusal to consort with Theages is not based on his assumption that Theages can't know the difference between right and wrong, but simply that philosophizing is not going to help him make that distinction. That he's not the kind of person who can sharpen his moral insight by trying to discover the nature of the soul and what's right by nature. That's the substance of his judgment here. Socrates, by rejecting Theages as a student, is not saying that he doesn't think Theages can know right from wrong, because I do believe that for Plato and for Socrates, that capacity is innate in human beings. But simply, it's his judgment that philosophizing is not the thing that's going to develop that capacity.
What's he basing it on?
He's basing it on a kind of sixth sense about human character. And again, this knowledge of erotic things is going to be a knowledge of the soul, but the soul can take on many different forms because there are many different types of human beings. And Socrates' capacity to act rightly, to act prudently, is based on his capacity to discern the different types of human beings and then to speak with them and deal with them appropriately to what type of person they are. To fit his speeches to the person he's speaking to. Yeah, and this is exactly what he's doing. He recognizes that the kinds of speeches that Theages needs are not the kinds of speeches he's giving. And he thinks that Theages might be better off even with the sophist than with him. But he certainly doesn't want Theages to become his own student. Because why? Well, because he recognizes that Theages would probably be corrupted. And so in a sense, by refusing to take on the student, Socrates is refusing to corrupt him. The father's wrong to think that Socrates couldn't corrupt him. Socrates knows he can corrupt the youth. He could make Theages a worse person by teaching him philosophy, but he chooses not to. And so he sends him on his way. And he realizes that even a sophist couldn't corrupt Theages as much as philosophy could. And of course, I think his preference would be for Theages to study, you know, with a gentleman, to be like his father.
Like his father.
Yeah, I think that's clearly his preference. He doesn't linger too long on trying to persuade Theages to follow the demagogues. What's going on with this daimonic voice is this. Socrates has a little bell that goes off in his head that basically says, okay, this is the wrong kind of person. It's basically what it is a personification of his judgment of human nature, right? But of course, he describes this in terms of this demonic sign, and the way he tells about it is very interesting, and it gives you a sense of his understanding of Theages. Theages is from the country, and it turns out that Theages is rather superstitious. And then so Socrates tells it in this way that you might tell, you know, ghost stories. Those who follow this turned out well, but those who refused to listen to it came to ruin, you know. And he goes and he piles it on. And Theages' response is very amusing. Okay, at the very end of the dialogue, Theages at 131a at the bottom of page 145, it's the last two lines in 145, says, after Socrates goes through this big story about all the people who've been benefited or harmed by listening to or not listening to his daimonion, Theages responds, to me, Socrates, it seems that we should do this. Make trial of this demonic thing by keeping company with one another. And if it permits us, this will be best. But if not, then at that time we shall immediately deliberate on what we ought to do, whether we shall keep company with someone else, or whether we will try to placate the divine thing that comes to you with prayers and sacrifices, and in whatever way the diviners prescribe. And so, Theages is a little bulldog, you know. He's not going to let go of Socrates. And he says, okay, Socrates, well, this is serious. But look, there are ways of managing these daimonic things. We'll find out You know, we'll test to see if I make any progress, and if I'm not, then we'll try and placate it through magic, basically. And he's very serious about this. And Socrates, and Demodocus says, don't oppose the lad any longer in these matters, Socrates, for what Theages says is well spoken. Socrates says, but if it seems that that's the way it has to be done, then that's the way we'll do. Poor he's not off the hook yet. He doesn't know what to do. I mean, and it is
all worn out.
If I give up, he says. Well, he doesn't want to hurt the lad's feelings, and his father's a fairly powerful man. He has to be diplomatic. So I mean, and he's being magnanimous, right? Because one of the great virtues of philosophy is, again, if you're dealing with somebody whom you regard as inferior, you don't make them feel that way. And this, of course, is an aristocratic virtue, right? If you are dealing with somebody who's inferior, you don't make them feel that way. And if you do, that's a sign of ill breeding. And Socrates is being very magnanimous here. He doesn't think that Theages is the right kind of student. But, you know, he's trying his best not to offend the poor lad. And he eventually is the sort of bully. You never know what the outcome of the story is, right? Yeah. But it is comic. And this brings us to another issue. This is not only, in many ways, a response to the clouds, but in some ways it also intimates that there are certain truths about what's in the clouds. But it's trying to show that Socrates isn't entirely at fault for some of the things that happen. Rumors get around and people come to him. He's sometimes strong-armed into taking on students. He doesn't want to. But what's really interesting is this. And this is why I said that Socrates didn't have this daimonion visiting him when he was a child, or ever since he was a child. Because if you look at the clouds, there's no sign that Socrates has a daimonion. He didn't know how to listen to the voice. He didn't know the distinction between right and wrong. And he also didn't have any knowledge of human nature. These are the things that are conspicuously absent in the clouds, and also absent is this daimonion, and these things are conspicuously present in Plato's dialogues. Well, the clouds was 423 BC, this is set 409 BC, so this is 14 years after. And so what we're seeing here is, in a sense, we're seeing that what Socrates learned from Aristophanes, one of the things you can say, is that he learned to have a daimonion. He learned the nature of erotic things, the nature of the soul, and he learned how to distinguish between right and wrong, and therefore he learned how to determine whether or not a person is a good or a bad student so that he doesn't corrupt them. Socrates in the clouds doesn't know these things, but Socrates here does. He is a good judge of human nature now, and this is a sign of change. Aristophanes in the clouds shows the pattern of a kind of philosophizing that you later see in Plato, in Plato's portrait of Socrates. If you look at Plato's Symposium, Aristophanes and Socrates are together about 8 years after the clouds, and they're very good friends. They're on good terms with one another. That, I think, is very important. If you also look at the Euthyphro next time, there's a passage where Socrates talks about how if the men who are going to try him are willing to laugh, he thinks he'll get along quite well. But if they're not willing to laugh, then the outcome is known only to you diviners, Euthyphro says. And what I take him to mean is this, and this is sort of putting a lot into this, reading a lot out of this. Socrates makes fools out of people all the time in Plato's dialogues. Now, if you're made a fool of, there are two possible responses to that. You can laugh at yourself. And if you can laugh at yourself, that's a sign that you can take a certain distance from yourself and learn from your folly and grow beyond it, right? But if you're a serious kind of person, meaning a person who can't laugh at themselves, then when somebody makes a fool out of you, you just hate them. Now, Socrates says, if these people are the kind who can laugh, things will go well because they'll be my friend after I make fools out of them and they learn their lesson, you know? He was made a fool of first, and because he could laugh at himself, he could learn. And who made a fool of Socrates more than Aristophanes, right? And I really do think that Aristophanes taught Socrates a lot. I think he taught him the nature of philosophy.